Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is songwriter Martin Page. But first of all, let's talk about some news that just came out this last week from the Worldwide Independent Network. That's a network of independent record labels. And they did a study and found out a lot of interesting statistics just in general about independent record labels. The first thing is indie record labels now comprise about 37% of the total global market, which is pretty amazing because once upon a time it was less than half that, and just about the whole market was comprised just of the major labels. But that's really made a big turn, especially in the last few years. Now, the other thing that's interesting is the fact that the average age of a record label, an indie record label, is 19 years old. So in other words, the average indie label has been in business for 19 years. Pretty amazing, huh? The average indie label also has 40 artists on their roster and has about 34 releases every year. The average indie label also has 16 employees. And more than 50%, about 52%, are owned by a major label or distributed by a major label. That's no surprise, I guess. We all pretty much figured that most indies, especially the larger ones, are really an imprint of the major labels. And that's, of course, still true, was true way back when, and still true now. About 72% have an international distributor. I would have thought that would have been higher, actually, that most indie labels would have an international distributor. But really, that's a little on the low side as far as I'm concerned. That being said, about a third of the income, well, really 37% of the income from a typical indie label comes from overseas. And believe it or not, most indie labels get more of their money from streaming than anything else. Usually when you think of an indie record label, you think of them distributing mostly physical product, vinyl, cassettes, because there's so many cassette-only labels now, believe it or not. You think of CDs. But in fact, more and more are making their money from streaming, which is a good thing because really that's the way everything is going. And thankfully, they're making a lot of their money that way and have figured that part of the business out, which is a really good thing. So just taking this study and looking at it from a global point of view, indie labels are doing pretty well. One might say they're doing better than ever, as a matter of fact. And they're growing in popularity, even though indie may be a little bit of a misnomer from the fact that if you're distributed by a major, you're really part of a major record label and not really an indie label, even though you may have more say over what goes on. Let's face it, when the money comes from a major label, you're not all that indie in the end. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyointercircle.com. Don't forget to check out my new Brand Your Music Crash Course, as well as my 101 Mixing Tricks program, and my other online video courses. You can go to bobbyosinskicourses.com to learn more. Now, last week, I went to something called The Show, T-H-E, Show, and really what it is the high-end show, high-end audio show. It was down in Newport Beach, California. Really, it was in Irvine. It was at a very nice hotel there, the Hotel Irvine. And I was a guest of WireWorld. Thank you very much, Larry and David from WireWorld, for getting me in. And actually, for even getting me out of the house to go to something like that, because I haven't been to a hi-fi show in quite some time. So thanks for inviting me. I really enjoyed it. Now, what was interesting is, not having been to a show in a long time, there are a lot of things that were the same and a lot that were different. The things that were different were the names of the companies that were there. As I walked around, I didn't recognize many of them as compared to the last time I had been at a show. Most of the major companies that had been there, and I'm saying 10 plus years ago, I had recognized, and they've been around for quite some time, and many of those companies were gone. I was surprised, and were replaced with a whole new set of companies that were basically all trying to do the same thing. They're trying to sell overpriced gear, people that have more money than they have ears in many cases. Hey, no problem. If you think it sounds great, then it does to you. So no problem there. And we all have our own tastes. That being said, in comparison to the things that we listen to in the studio all the time, boy, there are some big differences. Really, the biggest difference that I heard was in speakers. And speakers, of course, such a personal thing to begin with. But the fact of the matter is, it seemed like these hi-fi companies, or high-end audio companies, they seemed to concentrate on one end of the audio spectrum when it came to loudspeakers. So, for instance, you'd go into a room and you'd listen. And of course, these were hotel rooms, and in many cases, they were kind of decked out with some acoustic paneling or diffusers or whatever to make it sound good. And what struck me was the fact that all of a sudden you began to hear different parts of the frequency spectrum that kind of stood out. So, for instance, some manufacturers really concentrated on the high end. So you go in and everything be crystal clear and there'd be no low end. There'd be no bass at all. And you go into another room and it'd be quite the opposite, where they would, in fact, really go after low end and kind of forget the mid-range and the high end. So that seemed to be kind of odd. And of course, all of these speakers were very expensive as compared to what we're used to using in the studio. Of course, one of the major problems with hi-fi speakers has always been the fact that they're kind of delicate. So they never really translated into the studio because, you know, you just put a couple of high-power kick drums into them and poof, everything is gone. So that's always been the limiting factor in the studio for electrostatic speakers and things like that. Until recently, ribbon tweeters you didn't see very often. So that was one of the problems. Again, tubes everywhere, lots of tube amplifiers and lots of systems that were $100,000 plus, and even some systems that were integral in that the amplifier and the speaker only worked at one another, and you couldn't take either or and use them with the other components. The other thing that was interesting, and in many cases, there was a controller, a digital controller, which is basically the head and the brains of the system. And that makes sense where that would be the major portion of the system and would make the system work. But by and large, there was really nothing that knocked me out except for a couple of things. And the first thing was more interesting than knocked me out sound-wise. It was a company called High Fidelity Cables out of Canada. And what they were using was magnetic induction instead of cables that were made out of metal or alloy. So what was interesting there is you had what looked like cables, but in fact, they're big magnets. Did it sound any better? It was really hard to say, again, if there was any difference. But again, just looking at the technology, I found it very interesting. The one thing that did knock me out was a company called MBL out of Germany. MBL. And they had some speakers on display. I thought they were their big $250,000 a pair speakers, but I've come to find out that they're only $70,000 a pair. But wow, they were excellent. And it was very much like being there. Interestingly enough, when they played some things that were done like by a jazz band, you felt like you were there. I mean, it really was one of the better experiences, maybe one of the best experiences I've ever heard in a listening environment. Then when they played some things that were done in the studio, I was able to listen through in a way that I hadn't been able to before. So in other words, it was very apparent when delays were put on, even slight ones, Haas delays, and you know, the 30, 40 millisecond range. Reverb decays, you can hear the reverb decays very, very easily, and things like that that normally kind of get smeared. So all of that was a very nice experience, and that was probably the only one. So I doubt that I'll be going to another high-end show for quite a while, but that being said, I was pretty happy I went to this one. So thanks very much, Larry and David, for inviting me. That was a lot of fun. My guest today is songwriter Martin Page, who's had much success over the years, writing with everyone from Earth, Wind & Fire to Bernie Taupin to Robbie Robertson to Robbie Williams. Martin's also co-written a couple of worldwide number one hits, We Built the City for Jefferson Starship and These Dreams for Heart. I spoke with him via Skype from his studio in Los Angeles. Tell me about when you got started. Did you first play in like cover bands and things like that? Is that, or did you go right into doing your own music?
No, I actually, you're right, it was cover bands. You know, that's the way I started. I started a little bit late. I was about sort of 17 years old. And I started playing cover bands in England, but the cover bands I played in were, interesting enough, they were soul bands. They were playing American R&B and funk music. So I was really looking for that, those kinds of bands, because I was a bass player and I really enjoyed what I heard coming from America. And I joined a couple of bands early on in Oxford and then in Bristol, and before I came to London. And we were playing all the American air bases for Marines and for soldiers that were out of America and doing time in England. So that's how I really learned, you know, to play with a band. And you had to have your chops quite good as a player, because you were playing in front of a lot of these American Marines, which were very aware of the real sound that came from America. But yeah, Bobby, I started off really learning my trade from playing covers. But the covers were, you know, Wilson Pickett, Rufus, Earth, Wind & Fire. So I specifically looked for bands I could play with which were doing American soul music, really.
Were you fronting the band as well? Were you singing at that point?
No, I was too nervous to front in those days. I was singing, actually. I was singing harmonies, but no, I was usually joining a band that had a, you know, a strong lead singer, and I was just supporting in those days and learning, you know, because I was self-taught. And so to join some of these bands was pretty a big leap for me, because I was originally at art college, as all English musicians seem to be, and I was slowly breaking away from art college and doing auditions. But I didn't know anything about singing or any of that. It was just, I just wanted to get in a band and play bass. So I was always supporting in the early days.
Well, tell me, how did you get into writing then? That's a big leap, because,
yeah.
I have the same background, starting in cover bands and things like that, where
yeah.
all of a sudden you realize that you kind of have to do something else, but it's not easy to make that leap. So how did that happen for you?
I think when I look back, Bobby, it was to do with that I was in bands that were always trying to get a record deal. And although we were outside of London, I knew at an early stage, because I originally grew up in Southampton, and the centre still in England was always London, possibly a little bit Birmingham. So the bands I joined were all trying to get a record deal, and there we were as cover bands, and going in the studio and recording, you know, Pick Up the Pieces by the Average White Band, and it was great. But, you know, when we went to London to play these tapes, they'd say, yeah, but, you know, what's the original song? And it started to dawn on me that the power of a band getting a record deal, which, as I know you'll know, Bobby, is when you start off, that's the big goal, just to get into a professional studio and make a record. That's just the ultimate goal. And I started to realize that it was about the song. I started to realize that the song was the powerful thing. Yes, the band needed an image, particularly in England, but even if you had the image, it was all to do with the song. And maybe the record company would be interested in you, but they'd say, we'd have to find the song. And so I think it soaked through my skin that the most powerful thing you could have as a musician was the song. And I slowly, from bass playing, started to find myself fiddling with the keyboards if the keyboard player in the band wasn't playing them or a rehearsal. And I'd start to really listen hard to records that I really, really loved. There were a couple of seminal records that really hit me, like Goodbye Yellow Brick Road by Elton John, and it just stunned me, the ability of the songwriting. And of course, I grew up through the Beatles era, so when McCartney and Lennon broke on British TV, we were all hypnotized, and it was known then that these guys are writing their own songs, which is really quite unusual at that time. So I think what happened is I started to feel like the most powerful thing I could ever have is to understand songs, and that meant moving a little bit away from the bass and looking at chords, harmonies, harmonics. And I just basically, around the spare time of playing bass, I started to buy chord books and really listen hard to albums and follow the chord sequences. And then I would experiment myself. And then I think that also, Bobby, you know, made me sing, made me come out with melodies. So it was, I think that what forced me towards songwriting was the failure of my bands to really get record deals on just what we were doing, and that the biggest treasure in the world would be a good song. That's what I noticed when I hit London, that it was about songs.
When you were in Q-Field, was that your first band that was doing your original songs?
Yeah, yes, it was, Bobby. That was the first time. And I'd I'd made it to London with these other groups, and then I joined a band in London, and there I met Brian Fairweather, who was a Scottish guitarist who'd come down from Glasgow, and we both were in London trying to make it, and we just hit it off, and we were both in a band that was playing original material, but we couldn't get a record deal, but we decided to start our own thing. And so I got a little four-track, put it in a little flat in London, in Islington, and the two of us, just with a little small drum machine, decided that the biggest thing we wanted to do was get a publishing deal, not even record deal. We didn't really know what we were talking about, but we said, let's get a publishing deal first, which is really quite backwards. But we set about, in my little flat, writing on a four-track. And at that time, which was the beginning of the 80s, music was changing. And we were, you know, Ultravox, Tom Dolby, it was the introduction of the synthesizer and drum machines. And so we started to experiment in that kind of atmosphere. London was sort of changing. A lot of the romantic bands were breaking through. We made some demos, and which ironically weren't really synthesizer-oriented at first for our first deal. We were sort of writing ska kind of reggae. And yeah, it was bizarre, but we got a record deal with Jive Records on the strength of that ska record called Doctor on the Radio. And we were really feeding off of the beat and all the kind of blue beat ska music that was sort of happening, the Specials in London. Luckily, that got us a record deal. The single didn't break, but the record company, Jive Records, were good enough to say, we'll give you another shot. And that's when we changed our style, and I sort of bought a synthesizer and just really fell in love with that kind of music, Ultravox and Thompson Twins. We sort of fell into that groove, and it was very, very liberating to write that kind of music. We hit it at the right time, and we had a hit with Dancing in Heaven, and that's how that first album was made.
Do you feel that it was easier for you to write then when you changed your style? Did that make it easier for you? Yeah, really?
It did to me, Bobby. I often think about this, but I just had a little Casio keyboard, and I play all the instruments, but bass is my main instrument. So I sort of fiddle about on the other stuff and sort of come working out. But the synthesizer really gave me something. I think most of us got away with murder through the 80s. You know, that didn't really. Write on guitars continually, because you could get these wonderful sounds, hold these little, chord inversions and sound like an orchestra. And I sort of really felt like it magically was easy to get romance, spirit, and atmosphere across. And of course, it was a lucky period again, because the music was becoming very romantically atmospheric. You had the Human League, you didn't have to sing great, but you had to create feel. And Tom Dolby's album, The Age of Wireless, I thought was exceptional, and I still think it's like the Sgt. Pepper of synthesized albums. And yeah. I was very inspired by that, and the kind of nostalgia that was in that Tom Dolby record. You know, One of Our Submarines, very English, very after the Second World War. You could just feel all this new technology, but also with a romance and a nostalgia about it, and it really connected with me. And that's, I found, as you know, to make a long story short, sitting down with a small little Casio keyboard that could sustain notes, could make strange effects happen, and you could get a kind of reverb going, really opened me up to songwriting quite quickly, because it took away the trepidation of really having to know your instrument, like on a piano or guitar, really intimately. Although I understood the bass that well, I certainly didn't on keyboard. So the synthesizer, and I think I'm very fortunate that I took to it, because when I eventually came to America, I don't see myself as a sound person, but everybody hired me really for playing around with synthesizers, because I was very in tune with creating sounds. And very fortunate, I think, for a lot of people around that era, Peter Gabriel, Phil Collins. I think when the synthesizer appeared, we all felt like we had an orchestra behind us and we could play two notes and sound very, very wonderful,
Yeah, but, there's something about the synthesizer where you hit on a sound and it is inspirational. All of a sudden, there's just something that you go, oh, that's cool.
And absolutely.
That doesn't necessarily happen with other instruments the same way. I mean, you might hit a chord or something on piano or guitar where you go, oh, yeah, that's cool. But there's something about the sound of a synth that you'll hit even a preset and you go, oh, That's cool.
I totally agree with you. I totally agree with you, Bobby. I think it's a, you know, I think it's a spiritual connection with sound. I'm actually doing a lot of instrumental music myself now, and taking reverbs and echoes and experimenting, and it's spiritual to me. And I think, you know, when you go in very, very deeply into it, past maybe the Tom Dolby with the pop orientation, which is very skillful, you can look at a lot of those early German bands, the Kraut bands with the Cluster, and a lot of the early stuff by Eno and Tangerine Dream. Some of that, when I was coming to art college, when the kids were playing that, although I was in the pop, I was going, my goodness me, that's pretty outstanding. And I think, you know, in a way, when we don't tend to think this, but Tubular Bells, when it came out, had that feel of something modern and old at the same time.
Yeah.
And I have to agree with you. I think if you sit with a synthesizer and don't just go, oh, this is high, you know, this is the future, which is wonderful about it. I mean, synthesizers never seem to go out of fashion. But if you just listen to the pure sounds of them and just to get an inspiration, it's another world altogether. I agree with you. Yeah.
Well, how did you get to America? That's a big step for an English kid.
A 7-hour flight, Bobby.
Yeah.
7-hour flight across the Atlantic.
Yeah, but it's a big decision to say, oh, well, I'm going to America. I mean, I can understand how wonderful it is to finally do that, but on the other side, it must be very scary as well and intimidating.
Well, I think I was broken into it quite luckily and smoothly, because my father worked in America for British Aerospace, and he was always, when I was a kid, he was always traveling to America and coming back and bringing me records and things. And every now and then, you know, I'd leave school and spend 2 or 3 weeks over with him in Washington or some of these air bases. So, I picked up, that's why I think I fell in love with black music, because I was spending a lot of time following my father around the air bases and then going back to England with all these records. And I was down in South Carolina, Beaufort, for a long time. And in fact, my last solo record, Hotel of the Two Worlds, is really to do with that. That's what I, besides the Beatles in England, it was the funk music of James Brown and Bootsy and Parliament that I grew up in the Carolinas with. So I'd already made this trip across it with my dad a few times. And then when I was back in London in the early 80s with Brian, I always felt I had this funny feeling that I wrote more American than English. It was strange. I thought I tend to be, I think because of my time with my father, I think my blood sort of took in this swampy soul music. And you know, to make a long story short, when I was writing with Brian, although we were doing a Q-Thill record, we felt funky. And I thought, and this is just my own mind, but I thought Ultravox are stiff and Berlin and European, yet we are more, Q-Thill with Dancing in Heaven sounds more like Funkadelic meeting the Tubes, and we were very influenced by the records of that time from America, as well as the synthesizers in England. There was the Tubes completion backward theory that we thought was amazing.
Yeah, me too.
And so, yeah, we sort of formed, when we made the Q-Thill record, we had this sense, we thought, was going to happen in America if it does at all, and not in England. And it did, actually. Dancing in Heaven broke as an underground record in Los Angeles. And I got enough, you know, balls to say to Brian, let's go over there to L.A., and I'll do my homework on A&R departments, and let's bring all our songs that we're writing and just escape to Los Angeles for 3 weeks and meet everybody we possibly can, because we know that Dancing in Heaven has become a club record. And we did that. And the 3 weeks we had in L.A., walking from record company to record company, was phenomenal. We had a huge breakthrough because we came just at the right time. Everybody wanted to hire English guys, which were like Tom Dolby. Blinded by Science was breaking on the radio. And here we were, two English guys, you know, that used synthesizers and had a hit on K-Rock. And it just really sprung from there. And one thing led on to another. You know, it's quite a long story, but those initial 3 weeks in Los Angeles were mighty, and everybody wanted to seem to work with us. And we fell in touch, Brian and myself, with our idols. I mean, I ended up with Earth, Wind & Fire, who I absolutely worshipped, and Bernie Taupin from Elton's band. And we just worked with Kim Carnes and everybody in this very small space of time. And that led to getting a green card here. But I think deep down, I was very lucky to make this a, pricey of what I'm saying. My father initially came to work for British Aerospace, so I had a regular trips across and tasted it. And then in London, when we got the Jive record deal and made Dancing in Heaven, I thought now is the time to really try and get into Los Angeles, because deep down, I was very influenced by great American writers and bands. You know, I loved James Taylor, I loved Michael McDonald, the Doobie Brothers, and the Eagles. I just took that in as well. So it just seemed a natural thing for me to take Brian and Q-Field to Los Angeles.
Yeah, I get it. I get it. Okay, so now now you're here in L.A., and it, you just mentioned Bernie Taupin. So here is one of the greatest writers of the 20th century, along with Elton, and now you're writing with him.
Yeah, I still have to pinch myself on that, Bobby. As I said to you before, I grew up loving Goodbye, Elbert Road and Elton's writing. Elton's a huge influence on me, huge. Yeah. The Beatles and Elton really is where I sort of harmonically sort of came from, and early Peter Gabriel and Genesis. But I think, Bobby, I was in town at the right time. Everybody wanted to change their sound. Everybody wanted to move into this new English sound that was coming across, and it was challenging everybody in LA. It was challenging the Jackson Browns, the Joni Mitchells, and we know Joni Mitchell wanted to work with Tom Dolby, and we know that everybody was going, oh my God, it's the one man with a drum machine and a synthesizer. What are we going to do? It's the Dan Fogelbergs of the world are under bombing here. So I, with Bernie Taupin, what was fortunate was there was a publisher in town, Bob Scoro, who worked for Chapel Publishing, and he handled Bernie's publishing. And he'd met with me on one of in that 3 weeks that we were playing all our material around town like wildfire. And he said, you know, I'd love to put you a Bernie Taupin. And of course I went, oh my God, yes. Oh yeah. Yes, you know, oh yes, please. And I told him how much I revered Bernie's writing. And he made it happen, which was amazing. He said, you know, get with me, let's meet in a restaurant and sit down with Bernie and bring your album. And I thought, well, Bernie's not going to like the Q-Field record. But as I was just saying there, Bobby, everybody was willing to change. Everybody felt they had to move on. And it was the same for Bernie Taupin. We hit it off as people. Bernie was wanting to move a little bit into the future, as he said to me, because he wasn't really always working with Elton at that time. I think Elton was working with another lyricist. I gave him the Q-Field record, not expecting much, and he was quite up about it. He said, I've got two lyrics we should test ourselves on. And the two lyrics he brought to me, already written, because it's you work really to the lyrics with Bernie. He writes lyrics first. Will We Build This City and These Dreams. Those are the two lyrics he gave me.
And, really? Wow.
Yeah, they were the two first songs. In fact, These Dreams wasn't called These Dreams. It was called Boys in the Mist, and it was initially written for Stevie Nicks and Fleetwood Mac. And he gave it to Stevie Nicks, but she wasn't quite interested in it, so he gave it to me. And you can tell by looking at the lyrics of We Built the City that Bernie was pushing himself into a more of a futuristic push.
Mm-hmm.
And These Dreams was really the bridge, and I took the bridge and put it the chorus. I called him first and said, do you mind if I move some lyrics around? And I was very nervous, but he said, no, Elton does it all the time, have a go. And this was really Bernie testing me out, and so I did a quite comprehensive demos on a little 8-track at home and sent him a cassette, and he was wonderful. He just said, this is great, you know, I'm thrilled with this. And luckily, fortunate as it was, we had two number ones with the first two songs we did, so that joined us together for quite a while. Pretty magical time.
No kidding. Okay, so... Did you know that either of these songs or both were going to be hits? I mean, when you're writing,
no.
did you just have that feeling, okay, I know this one is going to be the one?
Yeah. I was thinking about that today, about something else, Bobby, because I'm about to do a little blog on working with Kim Carnes, and I realized that what I was writing at that time, and for Bernie, was songs I thought that Q-Field could do.
Mm-hmm.
I was still in the band mode, because we hadn't got off our label yet, and I thought, well, everybody's very, very thrilled about Q-Field and the kind of sound we make, and I wrote We Built This City thinking, really, that I could record this. I just wanted to make it very, very positive and exciting for Bernie. So I wrote We Built This City, and the demo, as everybody talks about, including Bernie talks to Rolling Stone about it, the demo is a very different creature to really what Starship did, although I'm very proud of what Starship did because it broke us through. The demo was very much more kind of organic, Peter Gabriel kind of Shock the Monkey kind of thing. But I was thinking of Q-Feel and the way that I wrote for Q-Feel. And these dreams I wrote as a track I imagine we could do if we were like Orchestra Maneuvers in the Dark. And the demo's different as well to the records slightly. So I was writing in a very synthesized and quite modern way. And I'll be honest with you, I knew I had a feeling in my stomach that We Built This City was going to do the job it had to do, which was to bring Bernie to me. I just wanted to win Bernie's confidence. I wanted to work with Bernie a great deal, and I wanted him to see that when he gave me a lyric, I could deliver, and it would be, something a little bit new and unusual at that time. And so when I think about those songs, and even the songs that I gave to Kim Carnes earlier on, it was me still writing for my own band. And I think I thought, if Bernie doesn't like him or nobody cuts these songs, and they were quite strange songs to cut, really, from the way I demoed them, because they were very new wave-ish. I thought, well, I'll record them, you know, they'll be my band. Yeah. So I was covering my backside, really. But I had a feeling when I was writing these dreams that it was quite special. And I remember after 10 minutes, after looking at his lyrics and writing it, I got my manager on the phone, and I just played her the thing I was recording down the phone, and went, don't you think this is amazing? And she said, I think so. And I could almost feel that these dreams was harmonically quite beautiful. I could feel it. And but, you know, the main thing for me, Bobby, was to get Bernie Taupin to call me up and go, that's great, we're on a run, let's go.
Yeah.
Of course, but, yeah, we were very fortunate. I mean, the song circulated for quite a while. This was a time, I must have, it isn't like now. I mean, songwriters in Los Angeles, you know, as you know, Bobby, they sent out their cassettes and they went around all town and everybody was listening to them and the phone would ring and you'd get a song on hold. And in fact, We Built the City was on hold for the motels and they didn't cut it. And Kim Carnes was going to cut These Dreams, but then she declined because it was a little bit of a high scale. And so the songs were circulating for quite a time and then bang. I'd originally worked with a keyboard player, Peter Wolf, and he always came to me for songs, and so he took both those songs, one for Starship and one for Heart. So again, relationships meant a big thing in town at that time.
Yeah, no kidding. Let's jump up for a little bit. I want to talk to you about your second solo album, Temple of the Muse. You had tremendous success on CD Baby, and you were an indie at that point, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, how did that happen? I mean, you had a tremendous success with that, and basically it was an album that had a lot of legs as well. It kept on coming back to number one on CD Baby, which is pretty amazing. How did you do that?
Yeah. Well, I don't really know, Bobby, to tell the truth. I mean, really, I recorded very late in my career. Going back just before that record, I'd recorded an album in the House of Stone and Light. And the gentleman I was telling you about, Bob Scorer, who put me with Bernie Taupin, had moved on to Mercury Records. And he said, you know, if I'm ever working in a record company, I'll bring you with me. So he did. And I made that solo record. And it did very well over a couple of years. And I toured it. And it was a slow build. But then, you know, I was on that album, In the House of Stone and Light, I was lucky to get the people I'd worked with to play on it. Robbie Robertson played guitar. I was lucky to get some of the Blue Nile from Scotland, who I worshipped as an independent band. And then Phil Collins played. So it was just one of those kind of records I thought I'd make at that period in my life with Mercury Records. And then after like two or three years, I started the next record. And then Mercury folded. And so that record wasn't going to come out. And during that period, my parents, who I was very close to, passed away. And I sort of went quiet for a while. And I thought, well, that was a great run. I like writing songs, but I'm not going to push for another release. Mercury had folded. Although I have a few songs up my sleeve, which was Temple of the Muse, I'm not in the mood to record because I was going through a little bit of grief. And then down the line, I sort of took a couple of months off of writing because I was dealing with these deaths. Music started to talk to me again, and I started to really feel like I needed to write music. At the time, I'd lost people. I felt like music wasn't important. And then after, I thought, no, it is. It's beginning to talk to me again. Luckily, a person, Mike Rodriguez, who you know very well and does his podcast, he stayed close to me from the touring. And he kept on pushing me, saying, you know, get back in the studio, let's get you Pro Tools. And I was still working on analog. And slowly he motivated me from a youthful place. And I learned that you could put these things out yourself and a little village concern. And that seemed to suit me because of the grief and the depression I was going through. I thought, I'm going to make a record that I care about again on a small scale, very personal, and I'll just put it out quietly. And so I finished the Temple of Muse, which is a bit of a moody record, and you wouldn't have really expected it after what I'd done. But it was very true to me and what I was feeling. And I put it out at CD Baby with just my manager and my own little label, Ironing Board. And we just thought, well, let's just do it and put the soul out. And lo and behold, there was still a following for me of a kind of, I suppose what I quite like is like a Blue Nile following. I had a good sort of 2,000 to 3,000 people that still liked House of Stone and Light. It had made quite an impression underneath the commercial waves as well as being commercial. And out of that album, which was phenomenal to me, is I had major artists cutting the songs from Temple of the Muse. We had Elaine Page, Starship did another one, Robbie Williams cut The Long Walk Home. And Elaine Page did Mi Morena, and Josh Groban did it. I mean, it was phenomenal to me, Bobby, because I wasn't really pushing like the wild man I was, and yet this album, which was really done in my garage, a failed album that was going to go on Mercury, I just finished it off quietly at home. And then it gave me a lot of confidence that I did have a bit of a following, and I could change my style and grow up old, putting out independent records, which seemed to do quite nicely, you know.
Yeah.
It was a nice surprise, Bobby, because there was a big gap between House of Stone Light and the Temple of the Muse, and it was very encouraging to me.
Martin, do you consider yourself a solo artist or a writer first?
Oh, a writer, without a doubt, yeah, writer. More. It's harder for me to perceive myself as an artist. It happened out of the blue because, as you said, Bobby, in the first question, you know, did you ever sing up front? And I didn't. I was always more interested in the groove and supporting. So when the change was when I did the Robbie Robertson solo record, and I was working with him and Daniel Lemoir. I was bringing these demos in for Fallen Angel and stuff I was working with, and he said, I like the way you sing. You should make your own record. And I said, well, I don't know. I'm just presenting my feel. And then my manager, Diane Poncher, said, you know, everybody cuts your songs and they want to copy what you do. And you're usually in there with the vocalist. And it sort of dawned on me, like, if ever I was going to do something myself, it would be now. And I'd watched Robbie Robertson work quite singly on his up at the Village studio, all on his own, constructing his album. And I thought, I like the way this works. He sat alone, he brings people in, and he molds this tapestry. And he'd encourage me, and so I started to do that at home. And I slowly got more confidence with my vocals. And then when I signed to Mercury, it was all a bit of a mystery to me, because I just thought, well, I'm going to make one really personable album. I didn't class myself, Bobby, as a kind of Diane Warren, Desmond Child kind of songwriter. I've always felt like when I worked with people like Go West or Paul Young, I fed into the machinery of the band. I was like a band player. So this sort of happened a little bit to my surprise. But without rambling on, I feel deep down it's about the song always to me. And when I do write a song, I want to sing it, to portray it. And then, of course, I was very fortunate in my career. My songs got recorded by phenomenal vocalists like Maurice White and Tom Jones and people. And even Elton was singing on Bernie's album. And so it was like, my God, you know, this is the epitome of great vocalists. So to me, it was a slow build up to believe that I could present my songs. But again, it was my manager and Robbie Robertson that said, you don't realize the passion you put in with your voice. You've got something that you should do. So I was encouraged by the people to do it, really. But I'm a writer more than anything, and then if I write a song I can sing, I'll do that as well.
Yeah. What's the hardest thing for you to do as a writer?
Lyrics, without a doubt on that. Lyrics, yeah. I grew into that as well, because I was very fortunate after when Bernie Taupin got involved with me, I could see straight away with the lyrics he put in front of me, I was dealing with a master. And I didn't always necessarily know what I was singing about. It was just right. It was just good. He never repeated himself, and he was just a master. And so I was very, very lucky that my apprenticeship was with great lyricists. Robbie Robertson was a great lyricist.
Yeah.
And then they put me with Robbie. Even Robbie Williams is a very, very visual lyricist. So I always did well when I was with other lyricists that were really strong. And they got me with Hal David for a while. And that was, again, I just felt like, my goodness, I'm getting such an education.
Okay.
Then when I did go to when I went to do my own solo records, I took a bit of a, I think I'd soaked in a lot of great, great ethic on how to write lyrics, and I started to plunge into it myself. And I was able to pull it through to a place where I felt confident with it, and I knew that it was reasonably strong. And I was talking, and I think in the later years, I wrote more about what I felt and what I knew, not in the early years when you just want to write and get a hit. This was me feeling, I was just being a little bit honest. And so I took it on much more and got confidence, because people would say to me, even Bernie would say, hey, some of the stuff you're writing is, you know, you're up there, it's great. And so that gave me a lot of confidence. But that's still, to this day, it's the hardest part of writing for me, is the lyrical content. I'll usually grasp the feel of it, the title and the motion, but then the getting down and knocking the hell out of it technically is always a bit of a drag to me. Harmonically, musically, and getting a feel is usually very quick. After that, the words will slow me down.
Yeah, I understand. So you've been lucky enough to work with all of these fabulous writers, and obviously you're in their league, or else you wouldn't be there as well. So that certainly speaks your abilities too.
I appreciate that.
What do you find, or do you find something that's kind of common with all of the people that you worked? Is there a work ethic? Is there an approach? Mm. Is there something that's common between them all?
That's a great question. I've never been asked that. But what comes to mind, really, is to me, and I hope I can express this properly, is a drive, a desire to create. You know, getting down to the nuts and bolts of it is that every time I was in a room with somebody, we were there for, because of the will to do something, the drive. And I know that sounds a very simple thing to say. You know, you think like, oh, well, they had a great voice. But it was the desire to be there, the desire that musicians were bumping into each other, that writers were sat in a room together. Right from Lennon and McCartney onwards, you know, those two people sat together with a will, an aim to do something. And I found that with everybody I worked with, it was never, the successful writing and the challenging writing was always with people that were willing to search something out. So I think the desire and the will was very, always, particularly through that early era of my career, whenever I came into a room to work with somebody of that magnitude, I realized that they were focused on a result. A desire to get their creativity out. And so when I think of everybody I've written with, even, you know, with the producers, even doing it, was this incredible desire to create. And I found that the best writing and the most successful writing in general was this kind of naive will and desire and passion to get a result. Otherwise, we wouldn't be sat there as human beings facing each other. And everybody I can think of that I worked with, I can still see their enthusiasm. I can see Bernie's enthusiasm with writing. I can see Robbie Robertson's fighting for something. And even recently with Robbie Williams, there's this kind of enthusiasm to create and to be heard and to create something out of nothing. And I feel that in all the best writing I did, that was the, however good people were, however strong they were in different avenues of songwriting, and it was the will to bring something forth that I felt was always there, always.
Okay, that being said, you've had a master class with so many of these great writers. What are the mistakes that you see other writers make that doesn't happen on this level of writers that you're used to being with?
Well, that's another great question. I would say that what I've felt when there's been unsuccessful writing, it has been because people are mimicking too much, copying too much, thinking that one strategy is totally the way to be, and they're not versatile to move into a different strategy when maybe something isn't working. I mean, it's, and I'm not blowing my own horn here, but the preparation you have to do to sit down with some of these people has to be a great deal of work on yourself. And so that if one idea doesn't work, another idea is ready to go. Before I would work with anybody, I had maybe a week before I got with them, and I'd make, write three or four different songs and make them, have them up my sleeve, knowing I didn't like to fail when I played an idea or I had to work with somebody and not have a concept. So I think preparation was always huge in my era and still is. You know, a really good writer comes to the room with all his armory, and that armory being creativity, like on being versatile, being flexible. And the problems that I found with writers I worked with or with I've seen recently sometimes, it's being so, and we have to, and I want to get this across properly, because you have to write with a certain goal in mind. So when I wrote We Built the City, I was obviously going, hey, you know, tempo good, bring up the energy, unusual lyrics, but let's think of Human League meeting, the Tubes meeting, Tom Dolby, let's see what that's like. So although it all reflected on what was happening in the marketplace, I wasn't locked down to saying this has to be like the Pointer Sisters, copy this. I always failed when people said do this like this. I always tried to find what was a mixture of things that were happening in the marketplace or that was lively in the air. So I think of a melting pot of saying, let's put, even with Q-Fill, with Dancing in Heaven, I was thinking of Parliament and Funkadelic with the Tubes and with us, English boys. So it's always a mixture. And We Built the City, These Dreams, all the things I had, but lots of people was a mixture. So I think the failure, and I could feel it in myself when I got too much like this has to be a certain style and copy exactly what has just happened. Well, I used to not do very well with that. I used to try and take, I think a good writer goes, hey, Stevie Wonder, Superstition, lovely. You've got to be influenced by things. But then to go into a melting pot and throw in that pot classical music, throw in that pot jazz, throw in Stanley Clarke, throw in some other things. And I think that was a key to my success, that whenever I worked with people, I was such a fan, so knowledgeable of the records, that I was able to, you know, be many things at one time. And I think that really sort of held me in good stead, because I had such a bizarre career with so many different people, you know, from Josh Groban to the Commodores. It's all over the place. And every time I get interviewed, they go, I'm so suspicious that you did all this. And I say, well, it's just because I'm a record fan. I'm an absolute kaleidoscope of different ideas. And I think that really helped me, that when I was writing songs for people, even for Go West, King of Wishful Thinking, I was thinking more of like Prince. When Go West came, I loved them. I knew about their music, and I knew what they'd done with Dancing on the Couch and their early records. But then I thought, Minneapolis, you know, the time. What would Pete Cox's voice be with the time? And then Fine Young Cannibals came out with a track that reminded me of that. So it was a mishmash. And I know I'm rambling again, but it's when I see a songwriter going, this is what I am, this is all I do, and this is where I stay, I think the not being flexible and being inspired by so many things and being versatile is the problem with songwriters. You've got to be, unless you're absolutely superb at one thing, which nobody can touch you at, which there are those kind of writers, I think the trap a writer can fall into is, how do I mimic what everybody likes? Now, I think you have to do that, even from Glenn Miller days. You have to say, hey, we're all in big bands here, and we know what people like. But it's the ones that have that, a little bit of originality in the melting pot, the ones that have a different ingredient slightly in their records that make you feel, or the songs, you go, oh, I love this, I know this, this is like Paul McCartney's Yesterday, but it's not quite. Yeah, then I think you have magic appearing. Then I think a magic goes on, the music goes on, and it's going, it will really communicate. That's how I feel. So I think the disease to keep away from is to absolutely copy. I think you need to be inspired, but then you have to say, let me throw some other ingredients in to see where this can really go. And it'll still taste to it very attractive, but it'll have other legs which are going forward, you know.
What scares you about the music business?
that I'm going to die and I can't do any more songs. Which is absolutely true. I think at my age, you'll go, oh my God, time's running out. Better get some more albums out, you know. So I'm scared of the old heart keeping up. Luckily, I feel good. But the music business itself, I'm a little teeny bit, I think, Bobby, in a cocoon, because I've sort of been very fortunate to be able to do these solo records that I'm able to get my mood out, and they do all right, and they sort of keep me quite comfortable, and so I'm able to do some of the deeper stuff I'd like to do. But I think what frightens me about, and I don't want to sound like, you know, most people do when they get to a certain age, like, it's not like our day, not like that. Well, I think it's probably really, and I've noticed this when you do the podcast, that you're one of those great guys that says, look, you know, things have to move on, and let's not get grumpy about this. All this is creativity. So I do feel this is all very natural, what's going on. But what I do tend to feel that hurts me a little bit when I go out into the world to taste it is this lack of reverence for music, the lack of reverence for where songs are created, the artistry, the craftsmanship, the masterworks. There's a little bit that's happened with high, fast technology, in my mind, that people have lost the sense of that it's very special, that it has been crafted and it has been worked on, and that the songwriter and the artist should be really respected for that. I think that that's the only thing that frightens me, is that the lack of reverence for the skill it takes for great classical orchestras to perform, and for people to learn their instruments and to bring something amazing into the world. I think there's a slight tinge in the air, and I know I'm a little bit of a cocoon because I'm in my own studio and making my own albums, but I do feel when I go outside that it's like, I think the kids in general think like, this is all free and we can get it from anywhere, it's in the air, and we pull it down. And of course, from my era and probably yours, you know, sometimes we would save up all our money and get one album, and we weren't sure we really liked the album, but we'd live with it and study the lyrics, and we'd get an inner sense of having a real camaraderie with the artist.
Yeah.
And now I feel it tends to be, who's the next one? Who's the next one? And I can pluck this music out of the air. I don't have to work for it. So there's I think the word I would use is, and I think it'll come around again, because I think
it's all cyclical, said, you know,
yeah. Yeah, cyclical. So I feel that, you know, when I see you on the podcast and the way you talk about things, I feel like, yes, this has all happened before in a different way. But that's the only thing that niggles me sometimes, is when great work might get passed over. It's like, yep, you know, I can just download that for free. No big deal. Move on.
So, I hear you.
But otherwise, deep down, I feel like nothing can really get in the way of good music. I still feel very positive that great music will still win the day. I still feel it.
Yeah, I agree. Last question for you, Martin. What's the best piece of business advice that either someone imparted to you or you learned along the way?
I think the best advice I've gotten, and this is would be your, as a songwriter, would be from my manager when I first came to America, which was to own your publishing, you know, to hold on to publishing rights. As a young writer, I just thought, I'm just so happy, as we see on YouTube, people just post things up and, you know, for nothing, and they just think like it's so good to be heard and downloaded and liked. But really, in the early days, to make my survival as a musician and to be able to buy my equipment, was that my manager said, you know, these, we want to get better percentages for you when you do publishing deals. And as she's doing now for me, which I have no concept of, because all we want as artists is to be seen. We'll do anything to just get our music out. She would, you know, she made a point of taking notes when these songs were really, when every song I wrote was dates logged. So now, after 30 years of some of these songs, we're able to pull back our publishing. Because as a songwriter, owning the copyright of your songs is ultimately your what you want. That is your lifeblood, and even if you have to sacrifice early on and give away your limbs and your fingernails and your hair, ultimately your hope is going to come back to you. And that's what I learned quite strong from just being a naive kid, was when I came across managers like Diane and Bob Cavallo with Earth, Wind & Fire, they would start to say, I start to learn that a songwriter control of his copyrights and not to give away his soul for having great work. And early on, when I came to LA, you know, you'd write a song for a big band and they'd say, well, you know, we're going to take all the songwriting credits. You can have the credit, but we're going to take all the money from you because we're a big band.
Yeah.
And even in the early days, although I wanted to break through, I just felt like this just isn't fair. So I think the best information I got was that songs are real things. Music is in the air, but really the copyright, the date you write the song, and when it's put down the paper and put down the tape, that is your own work that you hopefully will have a good percentage of for the rest of your life. That's the biggest thing I learned, and it's put me in good stead for doing music all my life.
Well, absolutely. That's great advice, and more people should take that to heart, definitely.
Thank you, Bobby.
To find out more about Martin and his latest music, go to martinpage.com. That's martinpage, all one word, .com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyosinski.com, or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyosinski.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.